You're listening to the Minnesota Progressive Repartee, here in the liberal land of long beards, lattes, and lutefisk. And now here are your hosts, Doug Padgett, Brett Johnson, and Hunter Hawes.
And welcome into the Minnesota Progressive Repartee for your Wednesday afternoon. Brett Johnson in studio. Coming up on the program, we have three great interviews that will cover a wide variety of topics, including the need for conservation here in our country and also in Minnesota. We're also going to be speaking with a guest about how we can increase the availability of affordable housing here in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota. And coming up next in just a few minutes, you'll be hearing an interview with Simon Clark, who is an expert on domestic right-wing terrorism, as we're going to be talking about the El Paso shooting and how we can counter the rise of right-wing terrorism. I should mention today's show is pre-recorded, and of course you're used to hearing Hunter Hawes hosting the Wednesday afternoon Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Unfortunately, last week, though, Hunter received some tough news as his mother passed away unexpectedly. We here at the station wish Hunter the best and are giving him some time off. So in the meantime, it'll be myself as well as Robert Pilot and a few other people that will be hosting the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Hunter does have a fundraiser going right now to help pay for funeral expenses. You can find that on our Facebook page on AM 950 Radio. Again, you can find more information about that fundraiser. Just head over to the Facebook page for AM 950 Radio. We're going to take a time out here on the program and come back with our first of three interviews on today's Minnesota Progressive Repartee. And we're back on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Brett Johnson in on your Wednesday afternoon. Well, unfortunately, just recently we had yet another domestic right-wing terrorism incident, this time with a shooting in El Paso, Texas. So where do we go from here? How big is this problem of domestic right-wing terrorism? Well, we're going to bring on an expert on this topic. His name is Simon Clark. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and he specializes in domestic right-wing terrorism, as we're going to delve deeper into this topic. Simon, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, I wish it could be a better topic, but unfortunately, we have yet another mass shooting. Going through back on my show a couple days ago, I listed some of these mass shootings we've had over the past few years that have been done by right-wing terrorists. And I think overall, I tallied about 13 of them, and of course, that wasn't even including all. Is this problem really as bad as, well, what I was looking at, or is this just maybe highlighting a few of the worst incidents, and maybe this problem isn't quite as big as we originally thought? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the director of the FBI says it's the biggest terrorist problem we've got. Every single person who was killed by terrorists in the U.S. last year was killed by white nationalist terrorists. We've got white nationalist attacks, not just in the U.S., right? In the U.S., in Germany, in the U.K., in New Zealand. I mean, this has become a global problem, and it's not getting any better.
Yeah, talking about that as well, that's an important aspect to bring up because it's not just in the U.S. We've seen all sorts of these attacks also in Europe as well, especially, correct?
That's right. That's right. And a lot of the ideology travels across borders, and sadly, so do the tactics. You know, these people are comparing notes.
So,
and, we talk about it as white nationalism, which is a fair description. But let's be clear, it's not about one nation. Right? This is a totally racial ideology. And it's a global racial ideology.
So
it makes it so dangerous.
Is this something that's really especially started to be propped up over the past few years, or has this been happening for a number of decades? And what's been leading to this rise of right-wing nationalist terrorism? Has it been an influx of immigration, especially, well, talking about in Europe's case, coming from areas of the Middle East or in the United States coming from Central America? Or has this been something that's been going on for years and years beyond just, you know, 2012, 2013?
So, I mean, we've got to go back in history a little bit. After all, probably the most successful terrorist movement ever in achieving its aims was the Ku Klux Klan in the 19th century and then in the early 20th century. We've had this kind of white nationalist violence for political ends before. This stream, what we're seeing now, kicks off in the early 1970s, so way before we're talking about immigration from Muslim countries or immigration from Central and South America. This is a very deliberate project to push back against the core ideas of liberal democracy. And they'll find the victims of the day, right? They'll find whoever they want to demagogue this particular time based on what's in the news. But let's be clear, this is not driven by the arrival of one or other ethnic group into your country. This is driven by a project to use violence for political ends.
And let's talk about some of the rhetoric that leaders, not just in our country, most notably President Trump, but also leaders in European countries as well. Does their rhetoric, even though they're not necessarily saying, hey, go out and kill these people, but they're normalizing words like infest and invasion. Does that contribute to these people feeling that they're justified and that their hatred of others is almost being normalized when we hear words like infest and invasion?
Absolutely. These are words of genocide, right? These are the words that the Rwandan radio was broadcasting before the genocide in Rwanda. These are words that have one purpose and only one purpose, is to say that those people are not human. Those people are your enemy. And you've got to stick with me and use violence against them. It's notable. I mean, let's take Italy just as one example. You know, a former Italian politician, guy who'd been elected, goes and takes his car and a gun, drives into a crowd of immigrants, and just starts shooting at random. These are not, you know, just weird 20-year-olds in their basement.
So talking about some solutions to trying to combat white nationalist terrorism, I think, well, one of the big parts of the solution is even recognizing the problem, because we hear from a lot of people that, hey, it's just a lone wolf doing this. How do we actually collect credible statistics that show that this is a big issue? Of course, we see some stats from places like the Center for American Progress, but is this the case where we need governments to actually collect statistics to show that we are having a major problem?
Very much so. Very much so. And I should call out groups like the Anti-Defamation League, who've done a wonderful job as private sector groups pulling out, you know, collecting statistics. But this is exactly what we need the Department of Justice to be doing, giving us the data to be able to do the work. Let's be clear, not only have the efforts to collect the data been poor, and that's why there are a whole bunch of bills right now that have passed the House that are waiting for the Senate to take them seriously to improve the data collection. But even in cases where the Department of Justice has collected the data, or the Department of Homeland Security have collected the data, that data has then been suppressed, right? And this is not an administration that wants to highlight the problem. It's an administration that cut back on the department, the division within the Department of Homeland Security that was supposed to keep an eye on white nationalist terrorism.
How are they suppressing the data? So, in essence, they are collecting some information on domestic terrorism, but you're saying they're suppressing this or maybe trying to mislead with some of this data that they have been collecting?
That's, I'm not aware of any misleading, but there was a report that finally came out last week, which Congress had asked for and which the administration had said didn't exist, and then somebody in the administration sent the report to Congress and said, well, actually, it does exist. And that was reported just a week ago.
Gotcha. In terms of our response, at least on the law enforcement side, I've seen some people say, well, maybe we need to go back to some of the tactics and the response we had after 9/11 with, of course, the terrorist attacks we had during that time. Do we need to essentially go to those sorts of lengths with domestic terrorism to combat this, or do we already have the resources to combat domestic terrorism, but we're just not using those tactics?
So I'd make a couple of points here. First of all, we made a lot of mistakes after 9/11, and we shouldn't go and repeat the same mistakes. So let's not treat this as a reason why we shouldn't protect people's civil liberties and we shouldn't respect the way the law works. Let's not go there again. We have a law enforcement problem, and there's some very serious good people in law enforcement, both at state and federal level, who are doing their best, and they deserve to be commended. And again, I'd call out Director Ray at the FBI, who has been speaking very honestly about this. There were some great people at the Department of Homeland Security who are trying to do good work. Many of them have been shuffled off to other jobs. But this is not just a law enforcement problem, right? This is a problem of society. I mean, let's be clear. What's driving this threat is political rhetoric, from politicians who use white nationalism for their own benefit, and that has to be called out every single time, and it has to be called out by everybody. This cannot be a partisan issue. And, of course, what makes this so deadly in the U.S. is the availability of weapons of war that people who've been radicalized can then use to commit extraordinary acts of violence. So, yes, let's do good law enforcement, and that means keeping an eye on people who are dangerous. That means arresting people before they've had a chance to commit acts of violence, as we've done. You know, we've done a pretty good job with the Islamist terrorists. We need to do a better job with the domestic terrorists. But let's, at the same time, call out politicians who play with this kind of rhetoric and then disown the violence when it happens. And let's, for goodness sake, do something about guns.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I like your term there as well, weapons of war, because yeah, it's not – that's essentially what these guns are that these white nationalist terrorists are using. They're not pistols. They're using actual guns that you would see in the military.
That's correct.
So one more aspect to talk about, and this is the social media, because we've seen the shooter in El Paso who posted on, I believe it was 8chan, his manifesto.
Yeah.
What do we need to do in terms of social media to combat this? Do we need to bring the government in, or do we need to put pressure on these private organizations to police a lot of this hate speech that they see?
So the first thing I would encourage us to do is to learn from other countries, and specifically to learn from New Zealand. Right, so New Zealand had this horrific terrorist attack earlier this year, a classic example of white supremacist violence against innocent Muslims in two mosques. And the New Zealand government, Jacinda Ardern has been a fantastic leader on this, did magnificent work. Right? So the first thing she did is she said, we are not going to glorify the murderer. I'm not even going to say his name. And they had a really successful policy of not promoting this creep's cause. But then she did something else. She called together a whole bunch of governments and all the social media companies who are in any way respectable, and they came together and issued what they called a Christ Church call, which says, we will not allow this kind of violent language on our properties. These are, after all, private sector companies. They can choose what they put on and what they don't put on. Guess which is the government that refused to sign on to that?
Oh, I'm guessing that would be, yes, ours, exactly.
So, that's what we should do. We should sign up to it. The social media companies, most of them, and it's not been easy, but thanks to people like Change the Terms and other really good civil rights groups, have got a bit better at this stuff. You know, perfect, there's still a lot of work to do, but they've started to act the right way. The social media companies that won't, the 8chans of the world, you know, they shouldn't be in business. But let's take our responsibility. We are citizens of the country that has refused to sign on to the Christchurch call. Let's push our elected officials to reverse that decision.
We've been speaking with Simon Clark. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and his area of expertise is domestic right-wing terrorism. Hey, Simon, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. I know we could probably talk a lot longer about this, but we are up against the clock, so really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It's a great honor. I'm glad you're really highlighting this.
And coming up next on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee, a conversation about the need for conservation, an important issue not just for preserving our ecosystem, but also allowing us to have more economic progress. That's on the way next here on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee with Brett Johnson on your Wednesday. And we're back here on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee on your Wednesday afternoon. Brett Johnson hosting today's program. Well, just recently, the UN Climate Report was released, which basically shows that our agriculture industry, not just in the United States, but the entire world, is in a really dire condition. And then we have this stat as well here in the United States. Apparently, every 30 seconds, a football field worth of America's natural areas is disappearing to roads, houses, pipelines, and other developments. So joining us to talk about the need for conservation is Matt Lee Ashley. He once served as the Deputy Chief of Staff at the Department of the Interior, and he's also now with the Center for American Progress. Matt, welcome to the program. And that's just an insane stat I read a second ago. Every 30 seconds, we're losing a football field worth of our natural areas. That's nuts.
It is nuts. Thanks for having me on, Brett. Yeah, it's a bit surprising because you know, we each experience kind of change near where we live in different ways. We might see kind of a shopping mall getting built or kind of a woodland being logged or taken down for housing, but it's hard to know what it adds up to. And so we commissioned a team of scientists to develop what is now the most comprehensive picture of the human footprint in the lower 48, and to map how that has changed over the last couple decades. And that's what they found, is that across the United States, we're losing an average of about a football field worth of natural area every 30 seconds. So sprawl is happening quickly, lots of land conversion is happening quickly, and there needs to be a conversation about how to step up our efforts to conserve the places that we want to pass down to our kids and grandkids.
Now, over at the Center for American Progress, which is the organization you're part of now, you guys have recently put together this study that says we should have a goal to try to conserve 30% of those areas by the year 2030. Can you talk about the scientific basis in coming up with those numbers? And overall, what kind of caused you to study the topic?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's not our goal. It's not one we pulled out of thin air. There's been a lot of scientific literature over the last couple of decades trying to understand how much nature, essentially, we need to keep around to be able to provide clean water and clean air, and also to have enough critters and biodiversity in the world to support our human communities. And there's a famed ecologist named E.O. Wilson who has written extensively about this, and his view is that we need about half of the planet in a natural condition to be able to support all life forms, so people as well as wildlife. We're a long ways away in the United States from protecting half of all land, and so scientists have said, hey, we need a goal to try to get ourselves on the right track. And so there's an effort to coalesce around a goal of protecting 30% of lands and oceans by 2030. Just for perspective, about 12% of the country right now is protected as a national park, a wildlife refuge, or wilderness area. So this would be a very ambitious target, and it would require us doing more to conserve lands and waters. But we would propose doing so in a way that is dynamic and flexible, and that acknowledges that it's not just the government here that would be doing the work, but ranchers and farmers and private landowners have a big role to play in being good stewards of our lands and wildlife.
So by protecting 30% as this goal, does that mean these are turned into national parks, or is future development prevented on these areas? What exactly does that mean by protecting 30%?
Yeah, it's not a one-size-fits-all answer. In some places, it does make sense to create wilderness areas or to create wildlife refuges that are managed by the government. But the other side of it is that in the U.S., we are really good at creating smart ways of managing natural places when we want to protect them. And so, the Farm Bill, for example, is full of really good conservation programs that help ranchers and farmers protect wetlands and wildlife habitat. And so we need to redouble those kinds of programs and support private-led conservation, state lands, helping tribal nations conserve lands that matter to them. So this is not a solution that can be applied evenly everywhere. This is about trying to help local communities do more to protect the places that matter to them nearby.
Over the past few years and decades, what's caused us to lose so much of these natural areas? Has it just been straight development through commercial and housing or pipelines, or is part of this climate change as well that's been causing us to lose so much of our natural areas?
It's a story that's a little bit different in each part of the country. So in the West, for example, there's been a lot of sprawl of cities. You see Las Vegas is a good example, kind of sprawling out and consuming open lands around it, and also a lot of oil and gas development in places like Wyoming and New Mexico. In the Midwest and in Minnesota, a lot of growth of farming into areas where there was previously ranching. So there's been a fair bit of sod busting in parts of the state. And then there's other kind of traditional threats to natural places like mines that are in places that have important ecological values. And climate change is contributing to the stresses on natural places, and in some ways the changes to the climate kind of make the protection of natural areas even more important, because as a place gets warmer and the habitat changes, wildlife need places to move. And so trying to not just protect individual pockets of lands, but trying to connect them through corridors of various kinds becomes really, really important in a changed climate.
Now, of course, we're located here in Minnesota, and we have one massive area that's, well, made up of natural land, and that, of course, is the Boundary Waters, located in northern Minnesota, which could possibly be affected by several mines, including Polymet, which, of course, we found out is owned by a giant corporation called Glencore. So a lot of people that oppose this are saying, well, if we can just get a guarantee, not just from Polymet, but from Glencore, saying that if there is an oil spill or a mining spill, that they're guaranteed to clean this up. But I like what you guys are saying. No, we should actually be conserving these areas because, well, cleanup isn't necessarily the best way to go about an environmental disaster, and ultimately not building a mining operation is the best way to protect those lands.
Yeah, and the reality is that a development proposal like that isn't just about the footprint of the mine. It's about the watershed around it because of the of high likelihood for spills and problems. I mean, a lot of parts of the country where, you know, look at the West, where there's kind of abandoned mines and mine tailings still all over the place. And when there's a breach of a tailings pond, it pollutes the rivers and streams for hundreds of miles downstream. And so when you're looking at the Boundary Waters, you have to think about the integrity of that entire landscape and what it means to the state of Minnesota and what it means to the economy up there. I think it's the most visited wilderness area in the country. So it's you know, a powerful economic engine in a lot of different ways for Minnesota, and certainly those natural attributes, the purity of the water and the remoteness of it, makes it extremely important to the state and to the country.
Yeah, and as you talked about the economic impact, is that almost a more powerful argument sometimes to make rather than just the environmental impact? Because sometimes people hear that, especially if they do lean a little bit more right, they say, well, the environment's fine. But yeah, if you start really affecting their economy, especially as you're talking about northern Minnesota, where tourism is a massive part in terms of how that area makes money, or if you bring in that economic aspect, that might also help us get to that 30% goal of conservation.
It can be. You know, the economic argument is an important one. We've done a fair bit of public opinion research over the years, though, and a desire to protect nature is not a view that is monopolized by any one party. We did some polling recently that found that about 80+% of Americans would actually support a goal of protecting 30% of lands and oceans by 2030. And I think a lot of that in the general support we get for conservation in polling is rooted in the common experiences that Americans have in the outdoors, and that you know, it's not always reflected in our politics. I'm sad to say that, you know, the things that happen at the local level by Democratic and Republican elected officials at the county and city level, for some reason that's not translating to Washington. And so there's not a whole lot that Congress is currently doing right now to help conserve lands and waters, even though the polling and local elected officials are often on the side of trying to protect places that matter to citizens nearby.
Do we have any examples from around the world or even locally here in specific states of how they've succeeded in terms of protecting some of their natural lands areas?
You know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a town or a county or a state, well, certainly a town or a county across the United States that doesn't have some park or open space or river that they're not proud to have protected. You know, I think about the wildlife refuge in Minneapolis right there along the river, which is, you know, in the heart of a city, and a lot of work has been done to protect and restore that, and it's become a place for kids to go and learn. There's a story behind each one of those places we've conserved in this country, and people are working to protect more, but the federal government in particular needs to provide more tools and more support to help accelerate those efforts if we're going to do a better job of slowing down the disappearance of natural areas in this country.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head right there. If you bring it to that local level where you say your local stream or your local wetland will be affected,
yep,
that definitely gets people a little bit more concerned about the topic.
You got it. That's right. And we, you know, we think locally for good reason. Those, you know, these are the places we know that are that we take our kids to, or that we hike. So, you know, what are the things that we can do to help create more outdoor opportunities for people, and to have solutions and policy ideas that fit the needs of local communities? And it just the unfortunately, you know, conservation has not been much of a national priority in the last couple decades, and we've seen the patterns in Congress. We've studied the number of bills that have passed, and the amount of land and ocean protected in recent Congresses has fallen from the 70s and 80s. So the pace of work, the pace of conservation work at the national level has really slowed. So it's time to you know, try to reignite that and try to get a new focus on kind of protecting and restoring wildlife populations, and doing the basic work of thinking through what are the natural places that we want to leave in good shape.
Absolutely. And well, the key is once those spaces are gone, they're generally not coming back. So you really only have one shot to protect them.
That's right. Or they're extremely expensive to restore. So it's a lot cheaper to protect something in the first case rather than trying to clean up something bad that happens to them.
We've been speaking with Matt Lee Ashley. He's the Senior Director of Environmental Strategy and Communications at the Center for American Progress, also served as the Deputy Chief of Staff at the Department of the Interior. Hey, Matt, thanks so much for taking some time to talk about this important topic that unfortunately doesn't get as much play as it probably should, but really appreciate you taking some time out today.
Thanks, Brett. I appreciate you having me on.
Coming up next on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee, we're going to switch gears and get a little more local, talking about the lack of affordable housing here in the Twin Cities and the state of Minnesota, as we'll be speaking with Chip Halbach. He's the former executive director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership.
Hi, this is Laura with Food Freedom Radio, and you are listening to the 4 o'clock Repartee, which kind of like means conversation between people or something. Something like that.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're listening to the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Brett Johnson hosting today's show. Well, one of the topics that you've been hearing Hunter and I talk about for a number of months here on the program is the lack of affordable housing, not just in the Twin Cities, but around the entire state and even, to be quite honest, the entire country. So we've talked about this for a while, and we figure, well, we got to bring on an expert on finding affordable housing and making it, well, more livable for people to find. And we are happy to be joined now by Chip Halbach. He is the former executive director and founder of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. Hey, Chip, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Brett.
Yeah, very important topic as we will head into 2020, because what's really struck me, Chip, is that during these four Democratic presidential debates, we've had no questions on affordable housing. And for me, this is a huge issue because I lived in an apartment prior to just moving to a new place that had rent, I think, overall increased by about 30% over a five-year period. Hunters run into that same situation. I have friends who have had to move back with parents, and yet we're not really seeing this talked about as much in the national and even the local conversation as it probably should be talked about.
Absolutely. And I guess the other side of that coin is at least it's being hinted at, and the particularly on the Democratic side, the candidates or the leading candidates are beginning, if not on the televised debates, at least in their policy positions, they are beginning to put forward some pretty aggressive housing plans.
Yeah, we are starting to see that at least, and it is more of a conversation than we've seen in previous years, but it's something that I think is going to be one of the big economic issues over the next few years. And I want to move along to this, just this insane stat that the Pioneer Press put out a few days ago, and that is you basically, if you make less than $30,000 a year, there are no vacancies for apartments. Now, granted, there are, of course, apartments that you can get if you make less than $30,000 a year, but there's no vacancies. And Chip, that makes it really tough if you're lower middle class to find somewhere to live in St. Paul or even Minneapolis, because I believe they're in a similar situation as well, where if you make less than $30,000 a year, you essentially won't be able to find any vacancies.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's for people at the lower end of the income spectrum, it's an emergency situation. And I think if we look statewide, there's for that income class, there's some 130,000 households that would fit that, whereas renter households, whereas there's only about 60-some thousand apartments that are occupied by people with those incomes. So what you have as a result of that is many, many, many lower income workers, retirees, and others paying well over 50% of their income for housing, which is not a sustainable situation.
And the stereotype we often hear is that, well, these are just people on Section 8 who are sitting at home and giving government benefits. But as I'm sure you have experience being the executive director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership, the majority, if not all of these people, are actually working. They have full-time jobs, but they're just not able to keep up with the rent as it continues to skyrocket over the past few months and years.
Yes, the vast majority of the people that are now accessing publicly subsidized housing, including Section 8 certificates, are either working, are senior citizens, retired, or have some sort of physical or mental handicap. It's a stereotype that doesn't help things to say that people are just sitting around collecting government subsidies. Now, these are people out there that either cannot, because of age or disability, bring in the needed income, or are just doing what they can with the jobs that are out there to raise whatever funds that they're able to bring in.
So this issue has certainly been highlighted over the past few years. Is this something that's just popped up over the past decade, maybe since the Great Recession? Or is this been something that's been happening even beyond the past decade or so, but now it's finally getting the attention it deserves?
Well, it's a little of both, Brett. I've been paying attention to the housing scene here in Minnesota a little over 40 years, so I've seen hardship from way back when. But since the recession, I think a couple of things have gone on. One is that there was a real slowdown in construction, particularly apartment construction, during and just after the recession. So you've had an expanding population and people with lower incomes. That population is growing, whereas the available housing is not anywhere near keeping up. And so you, since that recession, we've had incomes that have just basically kept pace with inflation, whereas rents have increased about 12-13%. So you have a greater squeeze going on, as well as in what is definitely connected with that squeeze is the super low vacancy rate that we have had since the recession and continue to this day.
Why has there been such a lack of affordable housing? Is it landlords that are now shying away from building these affordable housing units? Of course, I've seen the rise of these so-called luxury apartments. Is it that they're more apt to try to build those instead of affordable housing units? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's expensive to acquire land and build housing and go through the processes and and conform with all the regulations and that protect safety and health and community. And so it's not something that's done easily. And if, as investors sort of put forward their funds to create new housing, they will want as much return on that high-risk investment as they can get. And also then, at the same time, we've had the largest growing population of renters has been higher income renter population, in part because of the rules that have basically minimized condominium and just a general greater interest in people living in higher density areas close to downtown, uptown, that sort of thing. So you really have a industry and a rental housing industry that is producing what it can, but without government subsidy in there to offset the risk reward equation to make it more valuable for the developers to produce housing that with lower rents, you're just not seeing that type of production.
Yeah, exactly. One
other statistic that I want to make sure convey to your listeners is something that the Metropolitan Council put out. This would be just, of course, for the Twin Cities area. Earlier in this year, calendar 2019, they said that there were 7 new jobs being produced in the Twin Cities area for every new housing unit. So that is another thing going on here post-recession, is that the economy is doing pretty well in terms of producing jobs, bringing people and households into the metro area, but not doing nearly as well in terms of producing the housing for those households to live in. And of course, you're going to then get those with greater economic means to be the ones that are getting the available housing.
You were talking about possibly some of the answers could be subsidizing and giving builders incentives to build more affordable housing units. And of course, this problem is only going to get worse, especially in rural areas. We've talked about it on earlier programs, the Section 515 USDA rural rental housing and the number of those units that are no longer going to be on that program in the coming decades. What exactly do we need to do, at least from the government aspect, to incentivize builders to actually build homes that people can afford?
Well, the primary incentive.
I know it's a loaded question, obviously.
Yeah,
but
yeah. The primary incentive for the builders is just the funding to so that they find affordable housing development as profitable as other types of development. And that's a pretty big funding gap. But, you know, fortunately, there's a good community of developers here, both nonprofit and for-profit, and some public agency developers too, such as the Dakota County Community Development Agency, so that if there were greater funds, you would find production increase markedly. So that is the biggest barrier. Then beyond that, people are experimenting with government rules that allow greater density. Minneapolis just went through a controversial planning change that allow up to 3 units in any formerly single family zoned area. On the zoning side, it's making either of land that's available for higher density developments, such as along transportation corridors, or allowing accessory dwelling units, that's an added apartment that someone could create in connection with a single family home, or to actually take a formerly single family lot and put in up to 3 apartments. So all of that on the regulatory side helps too, but I just have to go back to saying the funding is the key issue here.
And that was part one of our interview with Chip Halbach talking about affordable housing in Minnesota. As you can probably tell, we are unfortunately up against the clock, so we'll play part two of our interview with Chip at a later date. Coming up tomorrow on the Repartee, it's another one of our solutions shows, as we're going to be talking about, well, a couple of solutions that I've thought of, including how we can reframe the minimum wage debate, and then also how we can get better Democratic representation in the U.S. Senate. We'll take your phone calls and solutions as well, so tune into the solutions show on the Repartee tomorrow.